There you go, the old Western Suburbs theme song. No doubt played many a time in the Pawley household from the 50s onwards, and probably even predating that, seeing our history in the rich area that is the inner west and western suburbs of Sydney. For those of you who are new to joining us here on Political Football, welcome back. It's been a long hiatus between episodes, but that makes even today's episode even more important. Even more stuff to cover, both on the policy side and in the sporting world. For those of you new to the podcast, I'm going to introduce to you my co-host, my longtime friend and future 10-time running New South Wales Teachers Federation of the Year Award, Mr. Joe Boyden. I think I cocked up that introduction, but that's fine. How are you? How you been,
mate? Thanks, mate. Thanks for welcoming me back onto the airways. I'm feeling really good. It's good to be back. I've been itching to get back on the mic and spit some truth to the people. I'm itching to go, mate. Thanks for that little intro. Kind of pumped me up there and put a bit of pressure on me, but, you know.
Well, a bit of a yin to the yang, right? You know, like I've been the sort of the economic sort of policy side to the debate. I bring the West Tigers perspective to the NRL discussion, whereas you bring the sort of real world teacher out there on the front line bureaucrat, the street level bureaucrat, you know, out there moulding young minds, changing lives. And, you know, in your case, a much more successful start to the season for the Parramatta Eels. But let's get into it. So the crux of today's episode will be talking about the competing narrative, the contrasting narrative, if you will, of the economic recovery, which seems to be humming along well, at least in a domestic sense, against the seems to be ever-increasing problems with the vaccination schedule for Australia, delays, issues with procurement and delivering it to getting them in arms, issues with the AstraZeneca rollout for under 50s. I'll get to that shortly, but I would like to note, I was planning on having an episode focusing on Indigenous issues relating to the incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people at a higher rate compared to their makeup of the population, and also more so the Aboriginal deaths in custody. We've seen 5 in the last month, and again, it goes to show that there's some conjecture over how well or to what extent the 1991 Royal Commission recommendations have been implemented. It's a contested space, but what it does show is obviously they're not working, or they're not working to their desired effect. So I just want to give that a special mention, because I think for someone like myself who's had it's a very strong passion of mine, Indigenous affairs. I think it's just not acceptable, and we truly can't call ourselves a great country to things like this, where Aboriginal people, when they get dragged into custody, again, there's evidence to prove, you know, they get put into prison for things that me and you wouldn't get put into prison for. They receive fines for me and you that would just be a warning. They get longer sentences, more court appearances. Anyway, there's plenty to digest in that area, but I just want to give that special acknowledgement. That was 30 years ago. This month, and we've still got a long way to go to achieve just outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and I think it needs a whole sort of reframing of the discussion. But we'll get to that another point. Joe, do you want to add any points there, or do you reckon I've summed that up well?
No, I think you've gone pretty well with that. I think a good way to look at it here is, like, there's never a perfect end goal.
100%.
There's always somewhere to improve, and there's always a better things to strive for. So 30 years is a long time. I mean, we would have liked to seen more change, but it's still good to look at it as there's a lot more to change and a lot more opportunity for growth in that system.
Well said. So let's move on to it now. So I'm not sure how much you've been keeping up with the economic recovery against the vaccine rollout, but
that's your world, mate.
Yeah, I'll try and give you a few numbers here.
You're
so
teach me and the people.
So, on the economic front, we've seen some good numbers, better than expected. Traditionally, when it comes to recessions, there's a sort of a large spike in unemployment at the beginning of the recession during the downturn, and then it takes a long while for jobs to come back online. The labour market's quite sticky. You know, you can lose a job in a day, but it takes months, you know, to go through interviews and the process of finding a job, right? So it's often a bit quite sticky, but what we've seen here with this recession, I suppose it's different to the other ones where it's been sort of economic policy has been in the heart of the recession, or a variety of economic conditions. This one was a sort of a government-imposed lockdown for it to sort of prevent a 1 in 100 year pandemic from causing, you know, widespread deaths and infections. So there was always hope there would be a sort of a V-shaped recovery, and it's certainly gone that way to a large degree. Now, there's certainly people, you know, the unemployment rate's still higher than it was 12 months ago. There's still, you know, some structurally unemployed. People in international, sort of the internationally dominated industries like tourism and the education sector are still struggling. So let's not pretend that I'm trying to be overly optimistic here, but those people certainly need some targeted packages, and hopefully we said that in the upcoming budget. But overall, I think across the political consensus, I would say the economic recovery is going stronger than much more anticipated.
Can I ask a question, sir?
Yes, sir.
I'm not, you know, this isn't my area, economics isn't my area, but is judging the economic recovery, are we looking at what it was like before the pandemic happened, or has the pandemic kind of changed the job market for good? So are the stats we're seeing now hard to compare with what it was before, because it's a whole different market now?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and probably a lot of people listening are thinking the exact same thing, and you've come to the right person. What we sort of look at is we're trying to compare everything, you know, sort of to what it was in sort of late 2019 or first quarter of last year. Obviously, first quarter of last year, people forget we had the bushfires.
Yeah.
So we actually had a sort of negative contractionary impact of that, because remember how widespread that was, yeah, New South Wales, ACT, Victoria, parts of Queensland, and sometimes the WA fires at one point or another. But my voice just went like Father Delaney, mum's old priest from when she was young. Got a bubble in my throat, but I digress. what we're looking at is actually the hiring intentions from business and job vacancies are at a 12-year high. So there's actually... employment's never, in terms of the people actually in work, mm-hmm, and in terms of the participation rate, so the amount of working age people that are actually available to work, that's never been higher. So we've actually seen an improvement on that, because there's sort of a natural jump. Anyway, I don't want to go too much into the sort of dynamics of it, but that's what it looks like at the superficial level. So in some regards, there's been a tightening labour market, and there's various reasons for that. But one is a lot of the sort of the international... sort of arrivals that we get, the sort of migration program we have, there was a large part of it that was temporary. So, you know, backpackers doing fruit picking or, you know, other sort of service roles that, you know, they're traditionally in the past that have been done by younger people. So those roles are now being filled in the domestic economy. So there's that natural demand effect coming through there. And it's an interesting point, because Ross Garneau touches on it in relation to our migration program. We've seen a huge jump over the last decade in temporary migration, and there's been some serious wage exploitation cases in relation to farm workers getting $3 an hour and nowhere near the minimum wage, and you know, there's issues with the gig economy are feel like they're overemphasized, but they are still issues as we go to a more casualized workforce. But yeah, overall, it's a very good picture. Again, I don't want to go too much into the nitty gritty, mate. I just love talking about it, as you may well know.
Yeah, you're teaching me. One thing I do like think about when I hear about jobs is a...
Yeah, it's a big one, isn't it? Jobs and growth.
It's just...
Jobs and growth.
Yeah, like, I think... I'm trying to think of, like... The way it's pitched is always, like, this just people lining up on the street who just need to be thrown into a job. Yeah. But, like, that's not often how it is. Often people look for the jobs that they're qualified in or the industries that they're interested in, right? So it's not always just the government trying to slot people into random jobs here and there. It, like, can that be quantified at all about the type of jobs that are getting filled by people who are seeking work in that industry, or is it too complex?
No, there's various breakdowns. Australia's economy is primarily service driven. So I've gone from a country that used to make things in manufacturing to a country that sort of we provide services to each other. Mm-hmm. So over 70% of our economy is service, could be even higher. That was just the last time I checked. But so there's what the growth has been in. Obviously, IT has been a big one. Professional services, financial services, you know, sort of continue to grow. But what they call human services. So people like yourself, right? The population has been the key driver of economic growth the last decade has been population, not productivity, or participation has gone up, but productivity certainly hasn't, or comparably to previous times. But what we see is, like, people in, you know, there's going to be a huge need for aged care going forward. You know, we've got an aging population. We've seen sort of these workers going, well, the sort of the good job they've done during the pandemic. They've been some of the most sort of exposed people. You know, it's a highly casualised workforce. A lot of them, you know, work between multiple aged care homes. So that's another question in itself. But you can certainly get the breakdown. Again, I'm going to try and go into the whole sort of breakdown of every industry, but I can certainly provide those numbers for you, mate, and I'll be happy to do so.
Yes, a lot of
them. But yeah, so that's one side of it. And there's also, in relation to the economic, it's not only the tightening labour market, that's something that I'm very interested in. I think I always look for unemployment levels, something I've always been interested in terms of the real economy. Again, I'm very interested in the real economy, how we affect everyday people's lives. So if you go from not having a job into a job, your living standards, most of all, probably jump significantly.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing overall. But you bring up a good point that we need to look, you know, at full-time work.
I guess I just
work.
Often think about the human choice in all of it outside of the statistic, you know what I mean? Because I'm lucky enough to have the luxury of working the jobs that I want to work, or working in the jobs in the industries that I like or that I'm interested in. So, I don't know, I'd like to see some sort of study on people who are working jobs they don't like, people who are working jobs they resent, versus the people who are unemployed because they're choosing not to take jobs in jobs they resent. You know what I mean?
I'm sure there's probably some numbers on it. I might speak to a couple of people I know and see what we can do for you, mate.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can do for you. But you're moving on now to the vaccine discussion. And I suppose what we see on one hand with the economic recovery and what sort of good public policy has done in terms of JobKeeper and the increase in the coronavirus supplement to the job seeker rate, even though they've been scaled back now and withdrawn, the economic hardship for at least people who were on JobKeeper seems to be eradicated because the labour market seems to be absorbing that. But on one side, we have the vaccine rollout. And I'm not sure, again, I don't want to be critical of anyone who's been involved. I'm sure it's a hard job when you're trying to logistically organise vaccinating an entire population within 12 months to get your international market and international borders reopened. But it's hard to think of how much it could have been, how like a worse job could have been done by you and I. I mean, there is multiple issues here. There's been an over-reliance of GPs in the vaccine strategy. Now, I get the point that the Prime Minister and the Health Minister have made in relation to, you know, people trust their local GP. You know, they've obviously interacted with them for over a long period of time. You know, it would help reduce vaccine hesitancy. But just when it comes to the logistic nature of it, they've got to run their own practice. They've got to see people who just come in sick generally or injuries or whatever the case may be. They're just got to run the day-to-day practice. How are they supposed to do that and administer vaccines on top of it?
Yeah, I think that's a bit rough. Like, I think if they're worried about people trusting the vaccine, that's the reason they're making GPs do it, then that's a bit of an issue in itself. Like, I feel like if you've legalised the vaccine and it's allowed to happen, you shouldn't have to take extra measures to make the people trust.
Well, I think it goes back to the public health campaign that they've run, and again, I think that's been quite poorly done. I'm someone, you know, we're both people who are relatively attuned to what's going on. You know, I'm still not 100% sure of when you know I'm supposed to be getting the vaccine as compared to mum. I know mum was supposed to be having it by now, she still hasn't got it. And let's not forget the most vulnerable people. That was supposed to be some people in aged care, disability homes, and whoever's in that phase 1A. That was supposed to be done by the end of March. But there's been 10% of disability homes vaccinated. Not if it's 10%, I don't quote me on this, 10 or 20%. Well, it's a very low number of aged care workers that have been vaccinated. The opposition minister today went to an aged care home in St Kilda where no workers or no residents had been vaccinated. So I suppose it goes back to this notion that we've seen over the last 12 months that the states are very good at the frontline service because, you know, teachers, doctors, you know, they're responsible for education and health. So, right, so they've had the years of experience in that, whereas federal government, foreign affairs, the economy, amongst other things, they're not very good at service delivery. We've seen that with numerous occasions, robo-debt, you know, over the years, we've seen many examples come through that. So whether they should have sort of shifted responsibility, now they've got this sort of 2 weeks sort of twice a week meeting of the National Cabinet. Scott Morrison put out a brief last week, you know, we're on a war footing, you know, to try and get the narrative back, you know. So I'm not sure how well that's going, but the more the states get involved, and you know, we've seen the federal government and the states, certainly the bigger states, Victoria and New South Wales, taking issue with each other with some of the remarks made by the federal government. That's not going to help anyone, you know, sort of, you know, politicking, if you will. So it needs to get back on track, and it's not something that I want us to be unsuccessful. You know, I wish I could be talking about this about in a successful way. You know, aged care population is vaccinated. We've met 4 million people by the end of March. You know, we're well on our way, but... your thoughts on the overall approach. What have you done differently? Would you have got mass vaccination clinics going? Would you have secured more deals earlier in the vaccine procurement stage last June, when they only signed Pfizer by November, and the US and the UK and other developed nations had jumped the queue on us?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not hugely depthly knowledgeable in this area, but.
Hugely depthly,
whatever bloody words you want to use. Long
That's
day.
All right, mate. It's been a long day.
It has been a massive day. But I guess one thing that I kind of think about this is I wouldn't have mind seeing, you know, just like ease up on the announcements until you have solid plans in place. Or like, I don't know, this kind of felt forced as soon as this vaccine came into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's obviously, like, as it would have expected to be, it just became agenda number one. How could it not? Everyone wants to get back on track. Everyone wants life to go back to normal. But I just couldn't see how trying to rush it out was going to be helpful. We'd already said international travel wasn't going to be able to happen for a long time. So then to then go and force feed the vaccine without a solid plan or without the vaccines in hand, actually ready to be delivered and given... I didn't see how that was ever going to work. A lot would have had to have gone right for that to be successful. So I guess a little bit more of a delayed approach and more of a planned out method would have been good. But yeah, I think as I was going to say before, the states did such a good job on setting up those testing facilities.
Yep.
Outside of GPs. So something like that as well. Like, I don't understand why they can't set up vaccine facilities like that,
yeah,
keeping people away from GPs for issues like you said, for being able to go see a GP if you're actually sick, whereas if you're losing out on appointments to see a GP and you've got a sickness, you're losing it to someone coming to get a vaccine, that's a bit annoying,
because yeah,
that's something any nurse can do,
yeah,
at a clinic. So yeah, I think it just seemed a bit rushed to me. I'm not a genius in this area, but that's just how the dummy's eyes saw it. But yeah.
And that's good to get that sort of street level perspective that you so bring, but it's a good point that you bring up in relation to this all announcements, no attention to detail, sort of planning that should be in place. It's been sort of an argument the opposition's been hurling at the federal government for a while now. Again, we don't want to get into the politicking of it, but where there's substance, there's style, or where there's style, there's substance, whichever way you want to run it here at Political Football, that's where we like to operate, substance over style, is that there seems to be like such a thing, such a strong notion to get onto the controlling the narrative part, but you can only control the narrative if you've got the planning behind you, you know? Yeah. And so...
Or if you've made the action.
That's right. You know, there's been even talks this week, you know, that, you know, they're going to look to develop the technology here in Australia to do mRNA vaccines, which is what's required for Pfizer, Moderna, and a handful of other vaccines candidates that have been approved. But the only one that we can do here is the AstraZeneca one. As you said, that's been running into issues in terms of clotting, you know, evidence of clotting amongst those under 50. So there was talk about 12 months ago about that, you know, like... A vaccine, the vaccine technology of the future will be mRNA. And even if you develop it and then it doesn't get used, you can use it for future reference. So I think it goes back to sort of the way we treat science and manufacturing in this country. It needs to be rejigged. I feel like, you know, we do a lot of things well in this country, but I feel like we've let manufacturing slip by the wayside. And our sovereign manufacturing capability certainly could be bolstered. I mean, you look at the way after the car industry left, you know, not only did you have people working on the floor of the you know, plants in Geelong and Altona, but you had engineers, You know, you had data scientists. You know, you had all this sort of mixture of expertise, and it was just put into a vacuum, and you know, not much really happened of it. And you got to be able to channel that expertise. We do things really well in this country, but we struggle to commercialize things, and that goes back to again identifying opportunities when they come. And if we developed 12 months ago, what's to say that we couldn't produce Pfizer right now? They say, they reckon it takes about 12 months to develop it if you fast track it. That's another thing that could be looked at. Again, I don't want to divulge too much into it, but as you can see, we've exposed a variety of issues with the vaccine rollout. But wrapping up this first segment before we get into sport, and the reason I contrasted the two is because on one side you have the economic recovery going relatively well, ahead of schedule, unemployment going down, housing market booming, you know, pent up household demand from the savings rate that's going to drive consumption growth this year. On the other one, you have the bungle of the vaccine rollout. And sort of we've handled the pandemic so well, and incumbent leaders, especially at the state level, and from, you know, what polls have shown previously with Scott Morrison compared to Albanese, and the two-party preferred, even though that's narrowed now, and it's relatively close. He's generally been rewarded for his pandemic effort, but he's starting to get attributed some blame for the vaccine rather. So what do you think wins out? People traditionally have won, voted with their hip pocket, you know, issues going to hit them in their hip pocket. So the economic thing is one. Do you think that wins out over the vaccine rollout, or do you think there is some impact of the vaccine rollout, but not as severe because of how well we've gone economically, and people have been able to get on with their lives relatively normally as to other parts of the world?
I think it's too early to call. I still think there's a lot left to be done before you can make a final decision on that. It's like he's kind of celebrating a try before he scored it, you know?
Yeah.
Done everything right. He's running to the try line.
I do love a good sports metaphor.
He's celebrating, then the ball starts to slip. And I guess right now we're in the stage where the ball's slipping and whether he can hang on to it or not and put it down in the in goal. And
that's there you go. See.
But I guess another thing too, like, there's a lot, like, back on the rush to get the vaccine done. The cases are good right now. Country's coming back. Like, we're pretty on top of COVID. So again, I don't think we still haven't been given a date in the quite near future that we're going to be allowed to international travel. So I think that for me, again, reinforces a reason not to rush this vaccine. If we keep on top of the cases, keep doing quarantine, people coming overseas, just like we've been doing for the past 12 months or so, and we keep on top of it, I don't see why this vaccine needs to be gung-ho, get it out into everyone ASAP. I think it just has to start with the people who need it most, and then we work slowly and patiently and get it done right, rather than trying to over-rush it and overdo it, and then more issues come up, like with the blood clotting and stuff. That's not something you want. I mean, like, a bit utilitarian, but you'd rather be dealing with that with 10,000 people as opposed to 10 million people. And you don't want test subjects in the in general public. Yeah. But I think that's the issue when you rush things like this, is if you get it out into everyone before you know what the potential risks and backlash of it is, I just think that opens the door for way more issues. And we're going good right now. Cases are low.
Or effectively eliminated, right? You know,
yeah, effectively eliminated.
We're at 100% capacity. Dance floors are back since back. So
at this point, in my opinion, it's just get it to the most necessary now, and then just worry about yourself and worry about your family, but don't put yourself ahead of others who need it more than you do. And
of course, we couldn't access it. I don't believe it. I think it goes more to the point of the sort of the cost benefit analysis of it. And again, I don't want to be too much of an economist on this. You know, I tried to be as down to earth as possibly can. But you know, you look at the potential. You know, even in the case of the blood clotting, it was horrible that I think that Adelaide woman. I think she was Adelaide, a 48-year-old woman who passed away from having a blood clot. Is the first sort of there's been no COVID deaths this year, and she's passed away because it's been related to the vaccine clotting event that takes place. But overwhelmingly, it's saving lives. You know, it's saving
on
the lives.
Scale.
So I mean, like, nothing is perfect, but a vaccine is probably as close as you're going to get to what it is, and I'm sure it'll be developed. You know, just because we have the vaccine doesn't mean it's not going to be, new strains are going to be resistant to the vaccine. So there's all these issues going forward. The pandemic is going to be with us for a couple of years, but I think with Australia, the risk profile, unlike any other country in the world, or perhaps New Zealand is probably the only other country, maybe some Southeast Asian countries like Taiwan, is that we're going to have to increase our risk profile to when we open up our international borders, because there'll still be cases. Just because you have the vaccine doesn't mean you can't transmit the virus. So there's been talk about, you know, Australia's going to be willing to accept 1,000 cases a week when it reopens its borders or whatever it is. So these are decisions that are going to have to be made. Again, it's almost like you have to go with the least worst decision. So we'll leave it at that. It's been a tantalizing discussion. One point.
I want to see realistic coverage on an issue. So if there's an issue with the vaccine, but it's the percentage that it happens is absolutely minuscule. For example, you have prescription drugs that kill people daily. You have drugs like birth control that kill people, that more people than you know, that I've witnessed before. You have issues with medication that people take on a daily basis. So those statistics have to play into whether this vaccine, if it kills one in, you know, 20 million people, like you have to, that's going to make headlines because it's the biggest thing in the world right now. So I don't want to see things overblown like that. Of course. People's lives are the main focus and it's very important. But like, I just think how it's covered in the general.
Of course, 100%.
It's a massive...
I'm not sure if you know the story, but the reason Dr. Carl left, I think his profession as a doctor, was to go into the media and become like Dr. Carl and his sort of personality, is because he saw the decreasing rates of whooping cough vaccinations, and he was practicing and he saw a little baby die because they didn't have the whooping, not enough, you know, he got died from whooping cough in the hospital. So he decided that he'd be better suited to be out there putting forward the best medical science and the best medical evidence.
Yeah.
To execute that, because he saw a story on A Current Affair that gave equal amount of time to anti-vaxxers as it did to the case for getting vaccinated. So for me, you know, I think a lot of this stuff about anti-vaxxers is just attention grabbing to people trying to grab in the headlines. And the other reason is it's they've got financial motivations behind it. You know, they're selling some sort of alternative therapy. Yeah. So I like to call those people the tinfoil hat brigade. I'm not afraid to castrate them because it's a very minuscule percentage of the population.
And if you're one of those people, if you read something or you hear something said, relax. Relax. Go read something else. Find some different articles that say different things and weigh up what you see and find other people who say other things and make your own decision.
Well, happy just read some trustworthy news sources like the Herald or, you know, Financial Review or ABC.
But not just one.
ABC. Or
find yourself many sources of information.
That are reliable. That's the key thing. I'd steer clear of some other institutions as well, if you know what I mean. It's one last name starts with an M. But moving on... Moving on from that, we'll talk a bit about the NRL there. Again, we digressed there for a bit, but it's an interesting conversation. And by all means,
let the boys play.
That's right. Share us your thoughts. A bit of Eyes Up Footy never goes astray. Well, what I'm going to play for you now is a little snippet from Saturday night's epic clash between South Sydney Rabbitohs and the West Tigers. I'm not sure if you saw this game, but I'll just play the clip and then we'll go through it, and then a variety of other NRL discussions, and maybe you touch on AFL.
I thought we'd moved on from this.
The people need to know about this. The people need to know. Oh, this is when you play put the speaker. And that's where we're going to end it right there, because we literally won this game. In the top left screen of Fox Sports, it had Tigers 18, South 14, full time. Tigers had awarded this game, and then it goes to the bunker. Who's in the bunker? Mr. Henry Perinara. Mr. Henry, 10 penalties a game for the Tigers, Perinara. And then he goes, and the first view of Burgess's try, everyone thinks he's dropped it. You watch it real time, it's bounced in the in goal, and then what do? They go to a slight pause of a frame where he's got two fingers on it, two big clot-hopping fingers, And he puts it down, and then Madge poorly reacts. You wouldn't know that the cameras are on. It's almost like they're looking for him to concede or someone to concede. And then they give it to South Sydney. And it wasn't just this. There was a whole bunch of incidences in the game with Latrell Mitchell kicking out, Latrell Mitchell dropping an elbow on off of Luma after he put through a kick for Dane Laurie to score, sliding in with the knees after a try. The set restarts. I mean, South never get back to 10. They're always on the 8-meter lines. We've talked about this with confidants in the past. But I couldn't have been more proud of the boys for the effort they put in, especially after being questioned the week before against the Cowboys. And no doubt that first half against the Cowboys was diabolical. It was diabolical, in the words of an English commentator. But couldn't have been more proud. The Tigers' completion rate in the second half was 100%. Latrell put his foot on the sideline as well. They didn't get called back. There was a variety of decisions, but all I know is that Wes should have got the 2 points, and we found a way to not get the 2 points. And sure enough, you know, they did shoot up, and Burgess did go through a gaping hole, allowing them to put themselves an opportunity. But what a finish. I mean, I was at the AFL watching this on KO while I was watching the Swans lose in the last minute. Now, in terms of the two things that mattered more to me is obviously the Tigers. But I'm a Swans fan. If it was against Collingwood or someone, I mean, it would have been more upset. But of course, it's the Giants.
How was the blood pressure?
It was it was almost worth it for the minute where they gave Brooks a try. Because here I go, Burgess has nearly scored. Like, because when they watched it, the live frame, it was like he dropped it, right? Because like Sutton's gone, and then you see Brooks just like running down the other end, and no one's near him, and he's putting it down, and then you see Sutton run up the end, and it's a bit of a delay. He's awarded it. He's awarded. And I was with KB, a good mate of mine, and we just went up in arms. We just went up in arms, and I was just going off. Any other time, I probably would have got kicked out of the SCG members, but there was a few other Tigers fans in there, so I was able to get away with it. See, and
I don't know the reaction. I was watching it with the boys, and the reaction we had when Burgess like attempted to put the ball down, we all kind of froze and looked at each other like, oh, like that's going to get reviewed. Obviously, that's going to go upstairs. Yeah. So we were, and when Brooks was running away with it, very slowly, I might add, and you watch that video, but anyway, we were kind of just like, we weren't excited like he was actually running the field to score. You was kind of just that feeling that, oh, this is a dead play, obviously. Yeah. And I feel like he kind of felt like,
yeah, of too, course, 100%.
Kind of strolled to the line.
It would have been lovely to just see him flush out. 100%.
But yeah, I see the outrage. I definitely understand the outrage you Tigers fans would have faced seeing it got to that point where he ran the field and scored. Yeah. But I do think that was a little bit unfair for the refs not to pull the play back and go upstairs with Burgess, because they go upstairs with stuff like that every week.
I know,
every
but like the thing was, it was always going to be that way. But the way it played out, right? Like if he got tackled, then he, you know, if Brooks got tackled, like the whole South team was jumping on Burgess because they thought he scored.
It would have been incredibly hilarious if that was a try to Brooks. Like, watching that game, see Mansour and the boys on the sideline.
Yeah. It's like they can't believe they lost. Like, but the thing for me is, I can't believe South were $1.07 and we were $7.50. I mean, for me, that almost seems like a fix. But that's neither here nor there. A bit like last night, Big Daddy Brown and Paul Gallen.
That was match fixing, bro. he threw that. He barely got touched.
Even Brisbane, and we'll move on from that because I don't want to talk too much about it, but a much improved effort, but it'll mean nothing for the Tigers if we don't back it up this week against Manly. Home game. First time we're playing at Anzac Day in West Tigers history. I'll be in Balmain, coming from the long run, right arm over. A few tailwinds coming from the Barangaroo end, and then we'll see how we go. I think it's 1:45, so early game, and then back into the swing of things on Monday.
I think you've actually been shafted in the odds again this week after Manly's good game.
100%.
Tigers 2.60 to Manly $1.50. Manly have been woeful all year.
But for me, again, I hate looking at sports betting odds because I'm not sure. For me, the purity of the game is more so than sports. I totally agree,
but the reality of it is,
the NRL
just adds up what the general public think of the game. And that's saying, a lot of them are saying, you know, they must be saying
Manly. Well, because Tommy Turbo in Manly just makes a complete different team.
Yeah, I mean, that's one game back.
Without Tommy Turbo, they're slightly better than the New South Wales Cup team. With Tommy Turbo, they're a top 8 contender.
That's That's huge.
He's that good of a... I'd say on his day, he's in the top five players in the game. If not, for me, him and Tedesco are the two first players picked for New South Wales. They've got that much X factor. They bring that much to the table. That 2019 Game 2 in Perth was just absolute clinic by those two.
All right, for me, if the Tigers win... If Manly win against the Tigers this weekend, all right, cool. You'll have me a little bit more convinced. They versus Penrith in the next week. I can't see them getting within 20 to 30 points of Penrith.
I didn't say the top eight team. I said the top eight contender.
Then if they go and beat the Warriors the round after that, then yeah, no worries. I'll agree with you that they're a top eight contender. You heard it here first. I'll say Manly are a top eight contender, but I don't think one game back for Turbo, obviously great win, I don't think one heroic game back can just completely revolutionise Manly's chances of making the finals. I'm sorry, that's just me.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, I think it makes him a possibility to make the eight.
Oh, you hold the popular opinion right now. Yeah.
I don't have him making the eight. I just makes him a possibility. And it's good to see. I just can't remember the last time Manly won three in a row. So if Beck Quintal's listening, you're in for a world of pain this weekend, love, because you're going to get dismantled by the West Tigers.
The Tigers can beat a lot of teams if they play like they did against the Rabbits. The Rabbits didn't play great footy.
The thing is consistency. And we unsettled them, right? You know, like,
that's a big thing about that. That's a big thing.
People
about.
Say Tigers were redlining and Souths were down, and, you know, like, you know, it's one of those games you get maybe one in every five games where you get something like that. But
I don't like it when people say, yeah, it would have been different because the Rabbits were playing bad, or it would have been different because this team was playing bad. That's part of sport. Like showing up on the day is 50% of 100%, winning the ball game. So it's a good on the Tigers. They couldn't get the job done in the end, but if they play like that, they'll beat a lot of teams this year.
And now some market news. Let's check out the markets. Chad Townsend off to tropical North Queensland, signed a 3-year, $2 million deal.
I love it.
With the North Queensland Cowboys. I think it's good all around. I like to see these sort of moves.
Good business.
Big free market, man. Free market. I love the free market.
Business is
Does this set in motion musical chairs for the off-contract halves? So, of course, we're talking here about Sean Johnson, Mitchell Moses, Tom Dearden, Adam Reynolds, of course.
Tommy Dearden's joining.
Well, that's what the large expectation is. Allegedly.
I'm excited if it does. I like seeing this sort of stuff. I mean, I know Mitchell Moses could be on the move potentially if that's a domino effect and it does cause musical chairs, but I don't know. I love a bit of free agency.
It just gets you. Like, there's a bit of feeling when your club signs a player, isn't it? You know, it just warms you inside. It's like a hot chippy on a cold night.
Waking up in the morning, turning my phone over and seeing free agency news. Usually, it's like with the American sports because it happens in our night time. Yeah. But I sit there for half an hour every morning going. I love it. It excites me. I think. Where will we start? I guess we'll start with Chad Townsend moving out there. I think that's great for North Queensland being aggressive after they've lost a couple of players. They lost Michael Morgan earlier, shock retirement. They lost Josh Maguire. He's gone down to the Dragons. So I like that they're being aggressive now and they're going out and pursuing people after losing some of their marquee names. Because I can imagine as a fan, if you lost two of your biggest names in your team, and then your club wasn't being aggressive to chase other names or other talent, it'd be pretty, it'd be a bit of a letdown. So I love this for North Queensland. I think it's a bit of a, you know, kick up the guts to Brisbane too. Might pull their heads in a bit, cause them to be a bit more aggressive chasing some players. But yeah, I love this move. It's huge.
And now, just quickly, we'll run through the other players who are off contract. And I just want you to give me a one-word answer. Where do they land? First one, Adam Reynolds.
Cronulla,
yep. There seems to be the consensus there. Okay, that's good. I like that. I like that a lot. Mitchell Moses.
Parramatta.
Stays at Para?
I think he'd be silly not to test what he can get elsewhere. But I read this morning was saying how there's not a huge chat between the Eels players. Sorry, I know this is meant to be a one-word answer. But
So, mate, it's your team. You can expand a bit.
Allegedly, there's not a huge chat amongst the players at Parramatta about sticking together long term. Their sights are solely focused on their success this season. So I do think there's definitely the possibility Moses could move on, which, I mean, I'd be sad to see him go, but at the same time, that's a huge chunk of money the Eels can play with there. But yeah, I think he'd be silly not to see where he can go. He's a great young player and he's worth a lot of money. So, I mean...
Well, again, his next contract probably be the biggest contract that he gets. Yeah, so.
And that's the thing. So you can't blame the bloke. He's just looking after himself. I do think he'll end up back in Parramatta, but, I mean, good luck to him. I hope he does what's best for him and his family.
Sean Johnson.
Sharkies.
Sharks stays at Sharks?
Yeah, he stays. Especially coming off this injury. I just think... I'm not an agent, I'm not a player either, but I do think after a big injury, especially as you're starting to get into the deeper years of your career, like switching clubs, chasing a contract after an injury is very dangerous, or if you're playing for a contract off the back of an injury. I think it's good to trust the club that trusted you before your injury and rock with those guys.
Just as an outside chance to be different to you, could see him go back to the Warriors. New administration there. Gus Gould, Nathan Brown at the helm, they seem to be going, or places, they've got plenty of money to spend with Tuivasa-Sheck leaving, maybe a bit of a homecoming for SJ. That's just a change.
That would be unreal.
Yeah.
I do worry for the Warriors, though. They've become a higher target on a lot of people's radars since they've been in Australia off the back of COVID.
Yep.
I do worry that when they move back to New Zealand and they drift out of our media a little bit more and... kind of isolate themselves back over there, whether they'll struggle again as a smaller market team. But yeah, I mean, it'd be great to see Sean Johnson at the Warriors. A lot to play for, a lot of pride to play for. So,
and I know he's not a half, but he is a member of a spine. It's a spine that's going above expectations this year. He still hasn't got a contract offer from the club. Matthew Dufty. I mean, there'd surely be a few sort of suitors in the market. Given his attacking flair.
That's a tough one.
Does he stay?
Yeah, I think he stays. I think he'll draw some interest, but I don't think the role he'll get at another club will be as great as what the Dragons have for him now.
Well, that's that one. Again, that was quite an interesting little game we played there, but musical chairs and guess who. But moving on now to one of your favourite segments. For those of you new joining us to the podcast... Joe has some psychic abilities to see into the future as to what's going to happen. He's pulled off multiple ones in the past. Canberra make the preliminary final last year. Jack White, and there was a few other ones. He got a Penrith. He hit one on the Penrith on top of the head. But if you follow Joe's Nostradamus tips, you could be doing worse. So what are you going to hit us with this week, mate?
Well, based off what I'm seeing so far from my boys in out of Para, hot start to the year. They're looking good. I do know what happened last year when they crumbled mid-season. They had a few mid-season woes, but it's neither here nor there. I see a little bit of similarity to this season and last. So I'm going to say Penrith are going to go 15-0 before they meet Parramatta in round 16. And Parramatta put a 1 in their loss column. So I think Parramatta will be the first and only team again to beat Penrith this year.
Well, so that'll make, if I'm not sure whether the mask will be off by 1 or 2, because I'm not sure how, was it 17 Penrith won last year in a row?
17 straight. 17 after the straight. Parramatta game, 16-10.
Yeah. So they won 17 straight and they've gone 5-0 to start the season, or 6-0. How many, what are you around? Round 7?
What are
you,
round?
They're 1-5. So Tigers are 1-5. So, so they've gone 6-0.
Yep.
So they've effectively won their last 23 regular season games.
Yep.
And the only game they lost was the grand final. So you're saying effectively across a 40-game span, the only two games they would have lost would be to Para.
That's what I'm saying, mate.
Okay. That certainly fits the category of Nostradamus.
They also did beat Parramatta again last year.
They did the second time they played, season. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was nil all until... On the siren, on the halftime siren, Penrith.
And then you know what Brad Arthur said to him when he went back out? He says, "Nil all, boys. It's nil all. Start again. Start again, boys.
As always.
Start again.
As always."
Now, moving on to, I was going to do a power rankings, but I'll just give my explanation as to where I think the competition lies. So, we've got Panthers, Rabbitohs, Eels, Storm, your top four. Roosters, Dragons, Titans, Warriors, rounding out your top eight. Some notable mentions outside the eight. Well, Canberra sitting at 9th after a big loss last week at the Para. Newcastle sitting at 10th, Sharks 11th. So Titans and Warriors currently sitting on the fringe of the 8 there, and the Dragons as well. So it's probably those top 5 teams that are the genuine contenders, for being real with ourselves. And I still think Penrith and Melbourne are a class above. Those two teams, if I'm doing my forecast for third quarter this year come September or beginning of the fourth quarter, October, I am looking at the Panthers, and I'm looking at the Storm to play off again.
It's hard to disagree with that. I would love to see the Penrith win this year, if I'm being realistic. Eels got a lot of work ahead to win that, or to just make it past the second week of the finals, as they've been struggling to do in the last 4 or 5 years. But anyway, I was saying all off season that I think Bunnies are going to win the comp. I still think they have enough to do it, but when they start getting complacent with some of the issues they had with Mitchell
Walker
like early this season and last week against the Tigers, I think they're going to bump into some issues. So I think they got to take a serious look at what they got and appreciate it and move forward. I'm still backing the Bunnies. I had the feeling all off season. Obviously, they looked a bit shaky.
This is their year. If they don't win this year,
last season they looked shaky at the start of the year as well. Yeah. Everyone wrote them off, and then they came back and steamrolled.
Well, what am I about to do for South fans? Could be the greatest blessing in disguise. I know you're backing them in, but I'm going to go on a limb and say, put a line through them. Put a line through them. They don't have the starch that Penrith or Melbourne do. They don't have the resilience. When something goes wrong, Latrell, and I love what he does for the Indigenous community. I love him as a I think he's a great football player. I don't know. I don't think he should have been leading the Dally M's, and he certainly shouldn't have got 3 points on the weekend, but that's neither here nor there now that he's been suspended for 4 games and he's been ruled out of the Dally M effectively. Is that when a moment comes and he gets triggered by something, or you know he's dropped a ball, or you know he's missed a tackle, whatever the case may be, is he going to be the man that ability to drag himself off the canvas? Same with Walker. I think Reynolds is a very even Steven sort of character. That's why I think it's criminal they haven't offered him a multi-year deal, at least 2 years. I mean, that seems disrespectful for me, and I'm not sure what's going on there in the South administration, and it certainly wouldn't be happening if Bennett was coaching there next year. But of course, he's moving on and it's going to Jason Demetrio. I don't think he cares. There's been rumours that Reynolds and Bennett might be, you know, the face of the new Brisbane franchise when that gets up and going, and I think it's not next year, the year after. So whatever, that could be a chance there, outside chance there as well. But I just think the way the Panthers play, they just ping the ball from one side to the other. Confidence is a wonderful thing in football. There's lots of, you can have the skill, you can all have the talent in the world, but when you make winning a habit, and you just have so much trust in your inside man and the man outside you, it makes such a difference. And you can just see that the way they play you know, one goes from one moment where Cleary controls it to Luai on the other side, and you know, and Jerome Luai, you know, he's a contender for six. For New South Wales.
Confidence footy is at its best with Penrith, and watching the Penrith team play. But I guess that's where you see the difference between a confidence footy side like Penrith and then just a well-drilled system like Melbourne. What lets you down more is confidence. So confidence rides high with Penrith because they win a lot of games and they do well. But obviously we saw in the grand final when a bit of adversity comes and confidence lacks, that's when confidence footy goes out the window. And my own team, Parramatta, is the definition of a confidence footy team. They go down by 6 to 12 points, they're effectively out of the game. So confidence footy is great, and I see that in that Penrith team, but I want more of just a systematic dominance, so when confidence is down, they have a way to get back into the game, like Melbourne have done for the past decade or two. So and I think, I don't know. You can draw your line through the Bunnies, mate. Yeah. But
I just thought
they got champion. They got premiership.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. If you're being impartial, you don't put a line to them. It's just I'm still emotionally charged after the weekend's game, and I saw the way we took it to them, and I'm not sure if we'd get that close to Penrith or Melbourne. That's all I'm saying. In the game. Although we've got a good record against Melbourne, but not of the last 18 months. But that's neither here nor there. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us on Season 2, Episode 2. Cattle Dog. For those of you who do not know the story behind Cattle Dog, and for those of you who are not yet part of West Magpies or West Tigers folklore, the story goes that Tommy Radonikis, when he was coaching New South Wales, they were down in Queensland, not sure which game it was, but down in Queensland in the 90s when he was coaching them, and he needed a quarter of arms at half time. So he came up with the cry, "Cattle Dog! Cattle Dog!" And he was coaching Joey Johns and Mark Spud Carroll and Steve Beaver Menzies, who would have a bad bone in his body. And he said, Andrew Johns, his eyes lit up. Get the call and that cattle dog. And, you know, going out there seeing Andrew Johns getting knocked out for the cause of New South Wales. It's one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. It's stuff legends are made of, you know. Mark Spud Carroll, I love Spud. You know, he had no questions to get in there and get in the fight. He runs his own gym now. That's how good Spud is. I love Spud, right? And Steve Beaver Menzies, you know, he was like, "Oh, not the dreaded cattle dog." And then I think they turned it around, you know, and that's how the legendary cattle dog is born. And then New South Wales have a cattle dog as their mascot. I think his name's Bruce, you know?
Beautiful.
Brucey the cattle dog. They're good dogs. I think get a cattle dog. Yeah. But, Vale Tommy Radonikis, I know he's one of Mum's favourite players, so I thought I'd leave a bit of a segment at the end there for him. And, yeah, it's been a good ep. No doubt there's... you know, there'll be some feedback coming through. Again, send through your questions. We have plenty but you go through, but we've reached our time limit for today, so we'll save them up for next time.
That's it, mate.
And then we'll get going from there. I think our next episode, we'll see about this morning, we'll do a budget special. There'll be plenty in this year's budget. It'll be the last budget before an election. They usually include a couple of ticklers for the working mums and dads around Australia, but we'll see what happens there, bro. And then we'll go from there. So
definitely tune into that.
If you're still listening by this point in time, it's a miracle. Thanks for joining us and take care. Have a good weekend. Enjoy your Anzac Day and lest we forget.
Thanks for having me. Ripper.